Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man, the skipper brave and sure. 5 passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour. A 3-hour tour. But when this started getting rough, the tiny ship was tossed. If not for the courage of the fearless crew, the minnow would be lost. The minnow would be lost. The ship's aground on the shore of this uncharted desert isle, with Gilligan, the skipper too. A millionaire and his wife, the movie star, the professor and Mary Ann, here on Gilligan's Island.
Well, welcome everybody to Behind the Curtain. This is WGN-TV's Paul Lisnick. There isn't a person listening to this who doesn't know exactly what that theme song is, and you may be saying to yourself, and why do we get to hear that classic, iconic song, Gilligan's Island? And that's because we're going to take a look at the life of Bob Denver through his widow in a brand new book that has just come out called Gilligan's Dreams, The Other Side of the Island. And it makes sense that the word dreams is in the title, because Bob's wife is none other than Dreama Denver, and she joins me now for the podcast. Dreama, it is so good to talk to you. It's like, it's just bringing everything right in as I think about Bob and that classic show.
I know, it really is. I thank you so much for having me on, and I want to say, hearing that song just makes me feel happy. It's just so upbeat and so much fun, brings so many wonderful, wonderful memories to mind. So thank you for playing that. I feel like it was just for me.
It was, and here's the thing, as you even tell me that, I have read the book cover to cover, and I'll be honest, you know, a lot of hosts, you know, they kind of tell you they read the book, they didn't really read the book. I started reading this and found that I couldn't put it down because it's so personal, so in-depth. I mean, we learn so much about Bob, your life with Bob, and the world, and there's so much I want to ask you about, but I've got to tell you, you really are very candid in this book, and I think readers will really appreciate how much we learn. I thank you for that. So, let me start by asking you, one of the things you sort of say early on in the book, you know, you say when people would meet Bob, they would, to him, he's Gilligan. Now, by the way, to me, he was also Maynard G. Krebs from the Dobie Gillis show. But that being said, most people look at him and said, he's Gilligan. And you tell us in the book, you know, you're partly correct.
Yeah, well, you know, he had a lot of Gilligan's characteristics. I mean, honestly, the sweetness, the kindness, the goodness, but Bob was also at the same time a very different character. Obviously, he didn't fall out of hammocks here at home and get hit in the head with coconuts. Those things didn't happen. He was very deep and an avid reader, read at least, I'm not kidding, 4 or 5 books a week, and was so smart. He just knew something about everything, could talk to anybody about any subject. And I always said, you know, he was my... In my life, I feel like he was my greatest teacher because he was just so well versed in so many different areas. I felt blessed to have him. I really did.
Well, and people should know, you yourself are an actress, and I mean, you worked, prior to knowing Bob, you worked with Sal Mineo, Gail Gordon, of course, I Love Lucy, and so many other shows, fame, Lucy Show, and Al Lewis from the Munsters, and Doug McClure. I mean, you yourself have quite the roster of people you worked with, but of course, it was the magical play, Played Against Sam by Woody Allen, where you met, you were in that show with Bob, that's where you met. Now, I have to say that I, too, played the character of Alan in high school and Played Against Sam. I'm not going to say I was better than Bob in the performance, but I don't know. So let me ask you what it must have been like to meet him. If ever there was love at first sight, I guess that was it, right?
Oh, it was so funny because I was actually in Florida, in Orlando, visiting my family when a friend called me to tell me that they were auditioning for Play It Again, Sam, over in St. Petersburg. I would be great for the lead. I should go audition. So that's what I did. I went over. I got the part. And I said to the producer at the time, once I got the part, I said, so now who's going to be starring in the show? And she said, Bob Denver. And I looked at her and I went, Gilligan? And she said, yes. And I said, seriously, I'm going to have to do love scenes with Gilligan, really? And she said, well, if you want the part, yes, you're going to have to do that. And I was like, well, yeah, I want the part. So when I arrived for rehearsals about 2 weeks later, I got there before he did, all the cast did, actually. And we were standing there making small talk the way actors do when you're first meeting. And suddenly there was a voice in the doorway of the rehearsal area going, what the heck is a dreamer?
Right.
Because they had me on the marquee as Dreamer, Perry, which was my maiden name. And I raised my hand and said, that would be me. And he walked over and looked at me and he said, your name is Dreamer? And I said, no, my name is Dreama, which he also thought was very strange. And I don't know. He said, well, it's a pleasure to meet you, Dreama. And he took my hand and the cast, I mean, people who were standing around, one of the reviewers who reviewed the show on opening night, it was just obvious to everybody. There was so much chemistry there and actually electricity. I don't know where it came from. I had never experienced anything quite like that before, but it was the real deal because it lasted for almost 30 years. So, you know, whatever we were feeling in that moment was around for a long time.
Was real. And by the way, that's one of the reasons I said the book, I think, you tell me, the book is called Gilligan's Dreams because he called you Dreams.
He called me Dreams. And it was so funny when we were looking at titles and, you know, they came up with, we wanted Gilligan in the title for obvious reasons. And so they had talked about Gilligan's son and Gilligan's wife and all these different things. But I loved Gilligan's Dreams because not only did he call me that, so that really is, you know, the book is by me, but
right.
I thought it encompassed so many, that title, so many things, his dreams for our son, his dreams for the foundation, his dreams for us in our married life. It just felt like it encompassed a lot of different things besides just what he called me. So I always loved Gilligan's Dreams. And I hope other people like the title too.
Well, and I certainly did. But one of the things I pick up out of the book, Bob, is, you know, when we think of Gilligan, look, it's hard not to, right? We play a role. I do television. People just, you know, they just make assumptions about you and you play a role. So the Gilligan role, of course, there was always that little boy in him and people sort of thought that naivety was there. But you write about the fact that I'm going to pull a couple of things together here. But he would often look back on his life and he would talk to or think about little Bobby when he was a kid. And he basically asked you if you ever look back on little Dreama, told you to do the same, to do that. And then he talked about the importance of, you know, believing in, he said to you once, he believed in you more than you believed in yourself. I'm kind of wondering the importance of that retrospection, of looking back. And I'm wondering whether Bob believed in himself.
Ooh, nobody's ever asked me that before. I think he did. Bob was, he would have done it in a very quiet way. You know, I wouldn't have been running around proclaiming, you know, I know that I can, he wouldn't have been that way. But I think he did because he was just, you know, not a perfect person, but a very good person. And he did believe in that story that you just told about, you know, him loving little Bobby. When he came to me, we'd been married about, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 years. When he asked me one day, you know, do you ever think about little Dreama? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, do you ever sit down and get quiet with yourself and just think about her and what she was like and what she loved and what made her happy and what made her sad? And do you ever think about those things? And I said, no, I don't think so. And he said, you really should. He said, you should sit down. And this is for everybody out there listening. You should sit down, get her in your head and your heart, and wrap your arms around her and give her a hug because she is part of who you've grown to be. Her experiences shaped you. It was so emotional and moving when he talked. I wish you could hear him say it. When he talked to me about it, I got teary. And I said, do you do that? And he said, I do. He said, every once in a while, I sit down, I think about little Bobby. And nobody ever called him Bobby except for the castaways. Now, maybe when he was a little boy, maybe his parents did. But he said, I think about little Bobby and I thank him for being, you know, so instrumental in my life and making me who I am today. And I don't know, I just thought that was something worth sharing for people to look at. And because I think in the hubbub and the craziness of life, especially nowadays, you know, we don't do that. We don't think about our little selves and give ourselves some love and thank that person. So that was, I wanted to share that story because I thought it was something that a lot of people could benefit from.
Yeah. And of course your life, look, you share this in the book, so it's fair enough to talk about it. Life was not all just a bunch of coconuts, as we might say, when we're talking about Gilligan's Island. Bob had a drinking issue. And you talk about his fight with vodka. He didn't think he was an alcoholic. He would promise you that he wouldn't drink anymore, but he meant no more hard liquor. I mean, you write all about that. Share a little bit about, because then he turned to beer. But what, was Bob an alcoholic? Would you say that he was or not?
Oh, gosh. You know, I really debated about writing about this because I didn't want people to think differently of him. However, in retrospect and going by comments that I get from readers, it was another thing that we had to get through. It was the first big challenge. As you know, you've read the book, we had a lot of challenges in our marriage that had nothing to do with loving or not loving each other. And that was the first one, and it was kind of a big one. I don't know if I would call him like a raging alcoholic, but he had a drinking problem. He couldn't just go to dinner and have a glass of wine or an after-dinner drink. He couldn't just do the one. See, me, I've never been much of a drinker at all. So that, having one margarita at a Mexican restaurant, that would be normal for me. He couldn't do that. So in that regard, yes, he did have a problem. And yes, it did affect our lives early on. We fought it out for the first year and a half or so. And I decided to include it because I know there are people out there who go through exactly that same challenge, and that maybe, you know, something we did would be valuable for somebody else to read about and learn. You know, when I wrote this book, when Bob first passed away, I went on Amazon when it was nothing but a bookstore, and I was searching for any book that would tell me how to survive losing him, because I honestly felt like I couldn't. And so when I wrote the book, I wanted people to know the real Bob, because he was very special in so many ways. And I wanted to be that, hopefully, be that inspiration for anybody going through the diagnosis of a child or the loss of a spouse or, you know, a partner who drinks or any number of things that we went through. That really, I wanted it to be inspirational and for people to find hope in it. And I hope, as a person who's read it, you can tell me that I did that. That's what I'm hoping.
It's one of the reasons I brought it up, because there will, without question, everybody, I think, has alcoholism touched their life. It's touched my life. I mean, it's there. And so I think for people to read it and see how you always stood by him, you always stuck with it. But yet, you know, even Gilligan himself had issues in life. It goes to show there's nobody immune from the difficulties in life. And of course, he had, you know, fame to deal with. And look, you told stories. You were at the White House a couple of times, and one of those nights, he did some drinking there, right? And you talked about that as one of the most embarrassing nights of your life at the White House with the Clintons.
Yes, prior to meeting the president, yes. The night before, we had there was a big dinner that was sort of unexpected. Bob was, you know, I don't know that Bob was comfortable 100% of the time with his celebrity, because he just felt like, honestly, he just felt like he was Bob, who happened to do a TV show that was really popular for a lot of generations, and he didn't look at himself as anything special. So sometimes, in retrospect, I have wondered if, you know, that was a little bit of the kind of drinking for courage to be out there, you know, whatever. But yeah, that night was that was maybe the biggest fight we ever had. The most disappointing thing for me, because the night before we went to the White House to meet at the time President Clinton. He did get pretty snockered and it was just disappointing, because we, you know, those were the years where we were taking care of our severely autistic son. Now people need to know that, because that was a lot of stress.
Well, and we're going to, and I'm going to talk to you. I want to talk to you about Colin specifically. That's kind of a section that I want to go through. But because we want people to understand Bob and your life and all of that. But, you know, if I don't talk to you about Gilligan, I'm going to have a lot of upset people. So let's take a turn here for a moment. Let's take a turn here for a moment, talk about the show. First of all, you know, I know that that opening scene was filmed on Kauai because you write about that. But, you know, when I first went to Hawaii many years ago, I remember passing, I was on Oahu and I passed, I don't know, some area. And I was told by the tour guide, that's where they did the opening of Gilligan's Island. So you're sure it was on Kauai and not on Oahu?
No. The opening credits where you see the ship leaving the marina.
Yes.
When they're first on board and going out to sea. That was filmed on Oahu at a marina there. I'm not sure of the name of the marina. But what's interesting about that shot is if you look closely, there's a American flag at half-mast. And that was because President Kennedy had just been assassinated. And all the flags were at half-mast. So when you see that opening shot, you know, you might not notice it unless it was brought to your attention. So that was true there. Now, the opening of the actual episode, all of that was filmed on Kauai.
Gotcha. And so we get all that clear.
Yeah. So little, you know, the opening credits were the marina where the boat's going out. That was a marina in Oahu. And then, of course, the pilot episode was filmed on Kauai. And the interesting thing about it, because they ended up replacing three of what were the original characters, because they replaced three of them, there was very little of that footage that they shot on Kauai that they could actually use. I think there were a few scenes with the skipper and Gilligan, and but they replaced. They had two secretaries.
Yeah.
And Bunny, and I forget what the other one's name was. Two secretaries were on the cruise in the pilot, and then there was a high school science teacher. It was played by the gorgeous John Gavin. So the two girls were lesser known than he was. So when they got back, you know, when they showed the dailies to the suits at the studio, they weren't happy with those three characters for whatever reason and wanted them replaced. So that's how we got Marianne, Ginger the movie star, and Russell Johnson as the professor.
Right. And I know you write about all of those cast members and you have really very nice things to say about all of them. I know you were very friendly with Dawn Wells. I got to spend some time with Dawn a while ago. And it's obvious because she's not been gone that long. This book got finished probably just before she passed on.
Yeah, the book was finished. If you notice in the body of the book where I write about each of the cast members, I talk about her in the present tense. And I debated whether or not to change that. I decided to leave it the way I had written it, and then in the epilogue of the book, talk about losing her and her passing and all of that. And so, since you got to spend time with her, wasn't she just awesome?
She was so warm, so nice. She talked to me about having the original Marianne dress that she still had. And of course, she explained to me, didn't really have family. So not sure where that, you know, maybe hopefully goes to the Hollywood Museum or something as a result.
Right.
Actually, I do have one question that I wanted to ask you, which I think a lot of people, you know, you're very nice about Tina Louise and all of that. And there's always been this, you know, rumors out there that Tina Louise sort of resented the role. It's one of the reasons she didn't go back and do the return to movies. Can you shed some light on that?
Yeah, Tina. Well, I personally have never had a problem with her. I haven't really been around her all that much. Maybe three different times. Once at the White House, and once in L.A. for some function. The TV Land Awards, that kind of thing. So I've only been around her sort of in social situations, but she was a star before Gilligan's Island. She had done a movie that was quite probably not racy at all now, but considered a little bit racy back in those days, called God's Little Acre. She had starred in that. She was starring on Broadway, if I'm not mistaken, in I want to say Once Upon a Mattress, when she got the call from her agent about Gilligan's Island and decided to do it. And I think, you know, I think she just wanted to stretch as an actress and didn't want to be, you know, pigeonholed into the character of the movie star Ginger. She wanted to be able to, like all actors do, you know, everybody wants to stretch as an actor and do something different. And I think she sort of railed against that. I know Bob did at the very beginning when Gilligan first ended. and I didn't know him at this point, but he always told me that he kind of railed against it because, you know, he was only like 33 years old when the show ended, and he had a lot of acting years ahead of him, and he was so typecast as that character, it was frustrating for him. But as time went by, as he used to get so much snail mail, and when he would get snail mail that would have letters, and you can't believe how much this happened, but would have letters from people who are now grown-ups who grew up with the show telling him that that show was their only moment, half hour, hour, depending how long, you know, how many times it reran, that was their only hour of peace during the day. They were in abusive situations. They had alcoholic parents. They had, you know, whatever the disturbing situation might have been, that was their little island of calm, something they could look forward to. And as Bob kept getting more and more mail like that, and he really did get so much mail along those lines, he said, you know what? If I have created a character, been part of a show that did this for little kids, because you don't think about that kind of thing when you're
right,
when you're filming. You know, you don't think about, you just want to get the laughs and make it fun for people. And I don't think you're thinking about the depth of what it could be doing in somebody's life. And so he really learned by the time I met him, he embraced it completely. He was very happy to have been part of two shows, including, you know, Dobie Gillis, for those old enough to remember that show. He just felt very fortunate that he had had two shows that had a great impact and two characters that kind of went down in television history. So he learned to love it.
Yeah.
But Tina always fought it a bit. Yes, she did.
Yeah, I think so. And by the way, I have some television memorabilia and props. So I actually have a painting by Dwayne Hickman, who played Dobie Gillis. And I have one of Bob's Gilligan's hat that he signed. So one of his, you know, one of his caps that he wore. Yes, I'll have to send you a picture of that.
Oh, yeah.
And also, you had wonderful things to say about. Yeah. Yes. You have wonderful things to say about Jim Backus. Everybody loved him. And you talked about towards the end when he was ill, but he made kind of almost a cameo appearance in one of the last movies that they kind of replaced him with Thurston Howell IV, and the ovation he got from the crew after his scene.
That was amazing. You know, that was one of the highlights of my acting life, because I was in the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island. I played Mrs. Howell's social secretary, Lucinda, Southern girl. And the last scene, Jim came in the last day of filming. He couldn't, obviously he was not well, so he could not do the entire 2-hour movie, because which had been written around him, which is why they had to bring in a child that nobody knew the Howells ever had. Thurston Howell IV, played by the wonderful David Ruprecht. He did such a great job mimicking Jim and taking that on and doing it beautifully and successfully. But yeah, Jim came in, and of course he was very slow and he was not well, but you know, turn the camera on and actors always find a way to get where they need to be, and I just happened to be able to be in that scene with him, and it was amazing. And when he finished the scene, which was not a big long scene, he just basically came in to congratulate his son on winning the basketball game from the Harlem, you know, the Harlem Globetrotters and all of that. So when he finished and they said cut, I mean, literally everybody, and you know, on a movie set there are hundreds of people because there are crew members and actors and extras and all these things, and
right,
everybody stood up and gave him a standing ovation, and I think he was teary and we were all crying. It was just an amazing moment, and to my knowledge that is the last thing he ever did on film. So he was really amazing.
Years,
they all were. It was a wonderful cast. They were just exactly, you know, Natalie Schaefer was exactly like Mrs. Howell, Lorne Yetz and all, and Jim right. was hilariously funny and kept people in stitches all day long on the set. It was a really fun and wonderful place to be. And just let me say, when I was around for all the Gilligan movies, and the first movie when we walked on set, I could not have been made to feel more welcome. They treated me like I had been with Bob forever and just made it so comfortable and so wonderful. So it was a great, great, great time in my life.
one of the ups, certainly, obviously, in your life, which is great. I do want to bring up you guys had a son. Bob had kids from a previous marriage, but you had a son who was going to be named Rafferty and maybe Chance, but no, we settled on Colin, and I think you call him Co, if I pronounce that correctly.
Tell us about
you just call him CO. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
So tell us about him when he was born. I'm not going to even say this because you had a doctor who used a word to describe Colin and what you were going to deal with that I think is just such a wrong word to use. It began with the letter R. I'm not going to even repeat it. I think it's horrible. But talk about Colin. Colin has been a gift to you in many ways and has presented some challenges.
Oh, absolutely. He's been such a gift. What blows me away is he is 37 years old now, so that just makes me go like, I can't even believe that. But when he was 2 years old in 1986, he was diagnosed as severely the R word, which parents like me and like Bob don't like at all. That the term is just not, it doesn't describe correctly what it is. Anyway, over the years, starting probably in the late 90s, maybe 2000, it sort of changed into autism. So after Rain Man, remember the movie Rain Man?
Absolutely. Dustin Hoffman.
To be called autistic after that movie came out with Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise, it wasn't such a stigma because of that movie. I mean, that's just the way it was. So it changed. He was born in 1984, so somewhere in the 1900s, I sort of say, in the 1990s, it changed to autism, and that was more acceptable. But he was severely autistic. He had to have full-time care, our son did. And this is the thing, another reason I wrote the book. You know, a lot of Hollywood celebrities, Hollywood stars, television stars would never give up the adoration, the work, the fame, in order to take care of their son. But that's exactly what Bob did. So for 20 plus years, 365 days a year, 24/7, with no breaks, Bob and I gave full-time care to our son, who could not have survived on his own. And there was no discussion, there was no, should we do this? What am I going to do? Do I have to give up everything? There was none of that. It was just a given that we would take care of him. Now, Bob went out and did personal appearances and guest starring roles on things like ALF and Baywatch and shows like that. But he would only be gone for a few days and come back. And we just did the care all the time. And I have to tell you, anybody out there who's a caregiver of a person with any kind of special needs, it's daunting. I mean, it is exhausting in every way. It could possibly be exhausting physically, emotionally, mentally, financially. It's an exhausting thing to go through. But at the same time, we went through it together, which makes a huge difference. And people think it's rationalization, but truly, you do learn so much. It doesn't mean you don't get frustrated. It doesn't mean you don't want to, you know, I think I say in the book, I used to, when it would get too much, I would go into the bathroom of the master bedroom and curl up in a fetal position on the floor and cry. I didn't want to do it in front of Bob and worry him. I didn't want to do it in front of Colin, certainly, but sometimes when it was just too much, I would have to do that. I would have to have that release and try to do it somewhere by myself where I wouldn't affect anybody else. So it's a challenge for sure, but there are a lot of blessings in it at the same time. And maybe you can't see them in the moment, but as you go down the road and look back, you can see that there were so many blessings in that situation.
And I know Colin is, well, you give us in sort of towards the end of the book, Colin is well taken care of now. You see him, and which is wonderful. And I know that before Bob passed, you whispered into his ear that you would take care of CO and all would be well. I sort of don't want to wrap an interview on the loss of Bob, but for people that may not know, you know, he did die of cancer. It started with laryngitis and got worse. And I got the sense from reading the book, Bob was not ready to go. I mean, he had a lot of years ahead of him.
well, gosh, I mean, he was only 70, and you know, the older you get, the younger that seems. I can remember when 70 used to seem very old to me, not anymore. He was a young 70 too, and a young 70 also. And no, I don't think he was ready to go. But I, you know, somewhere during that 6 month period after he was diagnosed and went through so much. And if you've read my book, so you know that. And I didn't put half of what we went through. I just tried to hit the, you know, the high points of what we went through during that 6 month period. But you know, I don't think he was ready to go, but I think somewhere along the way, when you're that sick and you have that many, you know, there was never a day with any good news. There was never a day in those 6 months with any hopeful news that would make us think that everything could be okay and he'd be able to come home. And I think somewhere along the line, there was an acceptance on both our parts. I talk about mine, when they had, you know, I had a heart attack when my husband was dying. I don't mean to laugh. Yes. It wasn't funny at all. But that's another thing I can identify with people on. I, you know, the stress caused a heart attack. We had our son here in West Virginia with caregivers who were new to us at that point. They've been with him now for many, many years. But at that point, I didn't know them that well. And of course, we were in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, fighting for Bob's life. And it was a very, very difficult thing that caused me ultimately 4 months into it to have a heart attack. And they would make me come home after that for a few days, every other week. They wanted me to, because the stress of just everything. So I would come home, and it was one of those trips home that I really understood that I honestly just wanted him to have peace, whatever that meant. And again, not to get too heavy, but, you know, I think there was an acceptance on Bob's part, too, somewhere. He couldn't talk because his voice box had been removed, so he couldn't tell me that. But I sensed it from him that there was it was a difficult time. You think you're the only one going through it. And then through my book, other people tell me their stories. And I'm like, wow, you know, I thought my story was challenging, but a lot of people go through such challenging times with so much courage. That's what I wanted people to. Bob had so much courage at the end of his life that, you know, I always knew he was courageous, but it was just a whole different level that made me, you know, so proud to. I've always been proud of having been his wife, but really, really made me proud of him.
Well, you give us in this book the good, the bad, the ugly. Mostly it's the good. Yes, you do write about the arrest, you know, Bob went through. And then I never knew about your part. And, of course, fortunately, everything happening with regard to the possession of pot and all of that. People can read the book if they want to read that side of things. But the book is Gilligan's Dreams, The Other Side of the Island, Dream of Denver. Thanks for sharing in such candid detail the life of Bob Denver and your life and his life with you. It's amazing. And people can still catch you on Little Buddy Radio, right?
Right. Little Buddy Radio is online streaming, so you can listen to it anywhere. You can Bluetooth it in your car from the, what is it called? The app, it's escaping me. TuneIn Radio. You can get it on that app and listen to it. And of course, we still have the Denver Foundation and Always Free Honor Flight. And a lot of really amazing things have come my way since Bob passed away. That was another reason to write the book, to show people that you can survive and actually create a new life for yourself when you think you can't. That is fulfilling and gratifying, and that's what has happened to me. And I would hope that Bob would be really proud of the things I've gotten myself into since he left me.
No question. And by the way, I can't let you go. You know, you did just mention the Always Free Honor Flight. I took my dad on Honor Flight to Washington. It's the experience that at that time it was World War II vets, as he was. Now we're sort of losing all the World War II vets, and they're doing the Korean War and the Vietnam War. But these are flights that happen all over the country, and you're very active in that. And I got to tell you, you've been on it. I've been on it. It's one of the most emotional experiences you can imagine.
You can't put it into words and describe it. You really can't. You know, I founded the first honor flight program here in the state of West Virginia called Always Free Honor Flight. And we have made, up until COVID, we had made 10 trips. And, of course, 2020 was supposed to be our 11th. And so we haven't been able to make one yet. We're hoping in 2022 we'll be able to get back out there with our veterans. But it is the most overwhelming, and the word gratifying again, to spend that 24-hour period with these men and to hear their stories. And if your dad was World War II, let me just say, I love all of our veterans. I love our veterans so much, and they know that. But there is something really special about the World War II vets. I mean, they are just, they are not called the greatest generation for nothing. They are the most humble.
Without question. And,
humble.
Yeah, my dad never talked about his World War II experience, and that day brought it out of him. It was just an amazing change. We'll have to talk about that. And I know that you're close with Joe Manchin and all the folks in West Virginia, where you are now, who are so active in that. So thank you for the work you do in that program. And all the vets listening to us should certainly check out Honor Flight wherever you live, because they do happen in many places around the country. And by the way, I mentioned the pot thing, and I don't want to leave it like totally alone. Is it fair enough to assume that when that happened, the arrest for pot possession, the reality of it is, if that kind of thing happened today, it would almost be a joke. I mean, pot is even pretty much legal everywhere you go. It just seems so silly to look at it from now.
No, it really is. It's so, I almost didn't write about it. And I thought, well, you know, if people Google, they will see that. So I might as well tell them what it was like, because it was horrifying. It's not anything, certainly in those days, that was 1998. Nothing I would recommend. It was not fun. There was nothing about it that was that, you know, there was no positive anything to it. But again, it's all these years later. What is it now? 23 years later, I guess it is. It just seems, like you said, almost silly, because if it happened today, it probably wouldn't even make the news. Then it was all over the place. And again, not fun. I don't recommend it.
Well, look, today you have Bill Maher on TV just talking about. Yeah, Bill Maher talking about how he smokes pot. I mean, come on, it's a different world today, but it was part of the story, and you share it.
It was part of the story. It was another thing that we'd gone through, another thing that you know, it felt like, with Bob and me, it just felt like everything we went through brought us closer and made us stronger. Those things, you know, our child, all those things, nothing tore us apart. And the thing that would have been most apt to do that would have been the drinking thing, but obviously because of Colin, that sort of settled itself down for the most part, 98% of the time, and we were able to get through it. But yeah, it's just another one of those things we went through. It was really embarrassing at the time, and kind of scary at the time. And you love the thing. Do you remember the part where I told you all the detectives, they had found a big stack of 8x10s. And before they left the house, they asked Bob, would he sign these for their cousins and their nephews and their mother and dad, and, you know, all those things. So it was just, there was an element of humor in all of that too. It was a really good excuse
I would call that theater of the absurd. It's theater of the absurd, because you're absolutely right. We'll be back to arrest you tomorrow. But by the way, please sign this for my nephew. Unbelievable. No, but on the good front, they were going to go after you and let you go because you had to take care of CO.
Yeah, well, they did. They were like, you know, it was just a blessing that they did that, because I expected to be arrested too. It's a terrible thing when you're like, two people, all you're doing is taking care of your kids. You're under a lot of stress. You've been doing it at this point for, you know, 14 or 15 years. You are worn out. You don't bother anybody. We live on top of a mountain. We never went anywhere. We didn't socialize. We never did anything. We were just here trying to get through it. To have your life disrupted in a kind of overwhelming way like that it really wasn't fun. But again, all these years later, I can look back and laugh. I couldn't have done it at the time, but now I can.
Right. And now you're a children's book author. Four Bears in a Box is out there for people to enjoy, an Indie Award-winning book. I know you're going to work on other books. Bob would be so proud of you, and I can't thank you enough for the time you've spent with me. Dream of Denver,
Paul,
the book
I've
is Gilligan's Dream.
So much. You've asked really wonderful questions. Thank you.
Well, I thank you. We'll stay in touch. And, I'm going to end this, and I have to end it with a theme or with a closing theme, I'm sure you will understand. Dream of Denver, thank you for your time. The book is Gilligan's Dreams. Thanks for being with me, and here's some music to appropriately take us out.
Now this is the tale of our castaways. They're here for a long, long time. They'll have to make the best of things. It's an uphill climb. The first mate and his skipper too will do their very best to make the others comfortable in their tropic island nest.
No phone, no light,
no motor cars, not a single luxury. Like Robinson Crusoe, it's primitive as can be. So join us here each week, my friends. You're sure to get a smile from seven stranded castaways here on Gilligan's Isle.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.